Welcome to the checkout. President of the RWDSU Union, Stuart Applebaum. Thanks so much for making time for us, Stuart.
It's really good to be with you, Errol, and it's good to be with everyone who's listening. Thank you.
Right on. I'd heard about your work for many years. I have friends in the trade unions. A good friend of mine from college, I'm going to give a shout out to Charles Barley. He's a union lawyer. Told me many years about the awesome work you were doing. So appreciate your willingness to talk to us, as well as sharing your wisdom and insight. So first of all, can you give us just a brief overview of RWDSU, not only what it stands for, but the particular sectors with which you guys operate, and you know, just a little background on the union itself?
Sure. The RWDSU, the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, has been around for a long time, since 1937. We started as a solely retail union, representing workers in shoe stores, department stores, pharmacies, all sorts of retail facilities. And we grew over time, so that our name is somewhat anachronistic. We represent thousands and thousands of workers in the South who work in poultry plants. We do a lot of food processing. Our members make Post cereal and Quaker oats. We bottle Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. We make Yoplait yogurt, Gerber's, and Nestle's and Vlasic are some common names that people have heard of. And we also represent a lot of people who work in supermarkets and in department stores. And now we represent people who work in vineyards. That's very exciting.
That's amazing. We're going to get to that in just a few seconds. But I just want to interject that my grandma, Eva, who was a Holocaust survivor, was a retail union member back in the 50s and 60s. And I believe she may have been a member of RWDSU because she was based out of New York City. My dad doesn't remember, so I just want to just put that out there, that I may actually have a connection with you guys that I wasn't aware of.
Good.
So back to farm workers. Could you give us, first of all, a little context on the political economy of farm work in the United States? What are the laws, or I should say, therefore, lack of laws for farm labor in the United States?
It's really outrageous. When laws were enacted to protect other workers, farm workers were excluded. And there's a racial overtone to this discussion, because at the time, most of the farm workers were African American, and the people who enacted the laws did not want to have these workers get the same rights as everybody else. And it stayed that way for a very, very, very long time. In New York, it's hard to believe that farm workers were not allowed to have overtime pay. They were not entitled to other protections, and they were not allowed to come together to form unions. And so for years, we've been trying to change that. And we tried to change that as a matter of simple justice. People were being exploited. They were working 70-hour weeks. They were working 7 days a week. They were not getting overtime pay. And their conditions were bad. They toiled in extreme heat in summer months, and they were denied bathroom breaks and access to waters, all sorts of things that unions could deal with. And so the New York AFL-CIO, and I have to give credit to the president of the New York AFL-CIO, Dennis Hughes, before, now Mario Salento, made organizing farm workers in New York a priority. And we were there with them for over a decade. We've been fighting for a law that would respect farm workers and give them the same rights as other workers. And in 2019, we were finally able to get legislated enacted that allowed workers to get overtime pay. and to form unions and have other rights that workers have. And we did this in New York, where there are a lot of farm workers. And we've started to see the difference in some of the conditions. The owners in this multi-million dollar industry fought us tooth and nail, but we enacted the legislation. And we decided that we needed to go in and try to help workers organize. We've been doing that. And at Pindar Vineyards, which is in Long Island, a vineyard in Long Island, we were successful just within recent days. And now, for the very first time in New York State, farm workers have a union. And I think that is absolutely terrific.
That's monumental. Could you tell us a bit more about the Fair Labor for Farm Workers Act, how it came about, and what some of the stipulations are, particularly how it corrects some of the gaps in New Deal labor efforts?
Well, I think that part of what it does is that it says that workers are entitled to basic protections. We need to do better on overtime because we want overtime to be paid after 40 hours a week, and the law hasn't done that yet. And we need to lower the threshold before you get to overtime. There is a coalition of groups that made this a priority. We work closely with the rural and migrant ministries. Reverend Richard Witt is a hero in this effort. It's the AFL-CIO made this a priority, and we've been pushing legislation for years and years and years, and we couldn't get it through. There were even some Democrats in the state Senate who wouldn't support the legislation. But this, in 2019, with a Democratic majority and in the legislature and with a Democratic governor, we were finally able to get it signed.
So what are the upside potentials for farm workers who will be protected by a union contract?
Well, I think that we're going to be able to negotiate over wages and benefits and working conditions. We'll be able to negotiate over bathroom breaks. We'll be able to negotiate over transparency about the chemicals to which people are exposed and decide whether or not that should continue. We have problems. Look at the problems people have, which we'll want to address. People suffer from health problems such as dehydrations and cuts and broken limbs, and they often find themselves without adequate medical care. And when they seek medical care, they pay out of their own pockets. Because they need income to survive, even when workers are injured, they continue to work despite the damage it does to them. And I think that one of the problems in dealing with this industry is that a lot of workers may have documentation issues, because most of the workers in this industry in New York are immigrants. And I think that has meant that employers felt that the workers were not going to have any power. They were not going to be able to lift their heads. They were not going to be able to raise their voices. But that all changes when they have a union. And now they're going to be at the bargaining table. negotiating over all of these issues. The Farm Laborers Fair Labor Practices Act has enormous significance for farm workers, but all working people in New York. When any workers are exploited, it impacts all workers. And we recognize that. And as I keep saying, we're very excited.
That's amazing. What is the landscape you feel in farm work and agricultural work in New York for the future? Do you see, you know, additional campaigns? Are you working on additional campaigns? And do you foresee resistance coming from, you know, ownership of farms and landowners, you know, as this is a new sector for workers to be organizing?
Well, I have to say that this worker victory is really an inspiration to other farm workers. They are showing people what can be done. And we're going to be in negotiations for a first contract. And you ask if there are going to be other campaigns, there are already other campaigns. We're not just looking at one vineyard. We're not just looking at vineyards. We're looking at the entire industry. Conditions have to change. And the only way we believe that happens is through unionization and collective bargaining. We're already out there, and there are going to be campaigns across the state.
We've covered a really inspiring campaign by Migrant Justice called Milk with Dignity to put pressure on ice cream and dairy companies to recognize worker-led organizations. So it's good to see that there is another front, you know, in this struggle for protecting farm workers and, you know, giving them more rights and giving them, you know, access to, you know, American dream and their own dreams. So what are some ways that our listeners can support this work from a distance?
I think that there are a number of things that people can do. One, I think that they need to be talking about this. They should be tweeting about this. It should be all over social media, retweet stories about what's going on. Let's really let people know how bad the conditions are, which is going to help put pressure on employers. And we should be doing that. I have a favorite organization, which I would love to see people support. They can read about rural and migrant ministries. It's such a wonderful organization. And it's if people are able to help them financially, that would be wonderful. We're celebrating. It's fortuitous that this weekend is the 40th anniversary celebration of rural and migrant ministries. This victory could not have come at a better time. We couldn't have planned it for a better time. And I would like to lift up and support rural migrant ministries, which is doing important work with farm workers and not just in terms of unionization.
Yeah, we've covered actually a number of faith-based organizations who are involved in social justice organizing in the food sector. And it's something that I don't think folks realize, that there's that much interest and effort happening. And we would love to talk to rural and migrant ministries as well and elevate them as much as possible for their work.
I spoke at a conference a few years ago at the Vatican. And I thought for a gay Jew, that was interesting.
That's a big deal.
They asked me to come and speak. And I think that the theme of that conference is that there's something that unites faith groups. And it wasn't just for Catholic groups. Reverend Barber also spoke. And it's the theme really was that at its heart, what faith groups are supposed to be about is solidarity, which is exactly what the labor movement is supposed to be about. And we find that the faith community and the labor movement come together on issues like this. And we saw the same thing in Bessemer, Alabama, at the Amazon campaign, where faith groups were so supportive of the organizing that was going on, because the message at its core is the same: solidarity.
That's amazing. And it speaks to tikkun olam, to heal and repair the world that we have in the Jewish tradition, but also the long history of Jewish and Black solidarity on social struggles. Rabbi Abraham Heschel is a big influence for me.
And when you talk about Black solidarity as well, what was really exciting, if I could segue to the Amazon campaign, what was really, really exciting for us in Bessemer was the extraordinary support we received from the Black Lives Matter movement. It's a lot of unions say that they support Black Lives Matter, but this was an instance where the Black Lives Matter movement was saying that unionization and collective bargaining are part of the solution to systemic racism in the workplace. And the Black Lives Matter movement in Alabama, it was so wonderful, took out billboards at their own expense. We didn't pay for that. We weren't involved in that. At their own expense, encouraging people to vote for the union at Amazon.
That is amazing. And I think it also speaks to not only the fact that there is a solidarity with Black Lives Matter and the union movement, but there are so many companies, so many businesses that were tweeting Black Squares and talking Black Lives Matter, but have either been radio silent or, in the case of Amazon and many other companies, openly opposing unionization despite the long history of benefits and, you know, greater working conditions and wages that unionization gives to Black workers and all workers, but in particular Black, you know, people of color, you know, women workers have benefited so much. So that's amazing to hear. But can you give us an update? Actually, give us a quick overview of the Amazon campaign, of where it's at, and an update of what the next steps are, so folks know, because you guys were so, you know, crucial to that effort and were so in the middle of trying to organize Amazon workers in the Deep South.
Well, I'll step back a little bit. Amazon is transforming industry after industry in our economy, and their business model is feasting on public subsidies, paying little or no taxes at all, and mistreating and dehumanizing its workforce. And what that means is that if Amazon is able to succeed and go unchallenged, it's going to determine what the future of work looks like and how workers are going to be treated in the future. Workers told us over and over again how they felt like robots being managed by other robots. They would get their assignments from an algorithm. They would be disciplined by or fired by text message. They were under constant surveillance. They were expected to touch a package every 8 seconds. The pace was unbearable. People were being injured at some Amazon facilities. They have ambulances stationed outside in the expectation that people are going to collapse from the work. In Alabama, in the height of the summer, there is no air conditioning in the warehouses because the robots don't like it.
That is insane. I mean, everything else you said I've heard, but I've actually never heard that the warehouses are not air conditioned because the robots can't handle it. The robots are more important than the people.
Absolutely. In Amazon's mind, in Jeff Bezos's mind, it's his, and he's a little dissatisfied that his human employees are not as productive, he believes, as his robotic employees. Turnover, I mean, the conditions are so bad. It's Bezos likes to say we pay a good wage. Well, actually, it's not a good wage. It's lower than other logistic facilities, even in Alabama. And it's below the median wage in Alabama. It's not a good wage. But he likes to say, it's a good place to work. Look what we do for our workers. It's such a good place to work that they have 150% turnover every year.
Yeah.
People can't stomach the conditions there. And people came to us. They heard about our battle in New York, where we took on Amazon when they wanted to build a second headquarters. And we said, unless they change the way they operate, we don't want them, and we don't want to give them public dollars. It's billions of dollars to the wealthiest man in the universe. It shouldn't happen when they're such a bad operator unless they change the way they operate. And Amazon decided that they wouldn't build the headquarters in New York if it was expected that they'd be a better employer. And we learned a lesson from that. We learned a lesson that no matter how much maybe leverage or incentive there may be for Amazon to change, billions of dollars were at stake. It was a lengthy process before they decided on New York. That isn't going to work to change them. You actually have to confront them in a union election. For 25 years, there had never been a single election to organize the workers at a warehouse, and we thought that had to change. So when workers came to us in Alabama, we said, right on, we're there with you. And we began this campaign, and Amazon flooded the workplace, used every sort of tool they could to crush the organizing and crush the workers. We had a 7-week voting period, and I could spend the next few hours telling you what it was that Amazon did to break the union organizing. But let me just say, it was so bad that the NLRB, ruled that against Amazon time and time again on everything they wanted to do. And despite that, Amazon went ahead and did things that the National Labor Relations Board's agents told them they couldn't do. And after the vote was concluded, the hearing officer had lengthy hearings on the process and declared and demanded that there be a rerun election. And so what that means is that the hearing officer's recommendation, which is almost always approved by regional directors, is now before the acting regional director in Atlanta, and we anticipate that there is going to be a rerun election. I think the other thing that has happened too is that our campaign in Alabama has opened the door to further organizing, that others understand that there need to be elections and there need to be campaigns, and we welcome them. Because we know that Amazon is such a large force that not one union will be able to take them on. It has to be a commitment of the entire labor movement to take on Amazon. And we can't afford not to take them on. Right now, they're the second largest employer in the country, operating completely non-union and well on their way to become the largest employer in our country, transforming the industries in which they operate. So we expect that there is going to be a rerun election in Bessemer, Alabama.
Yeah, and I believe the Teamsters have also recently made an announcement that they're targeting Amazon for organizing too, because they're so deep in logistics and fulfillment, and Amazon's wages are sometimes half of what, you know, Teamster workers make in the same type of job, even sometimes the same city, is what I've heard of pretty frequently.
And let me tell you about the conditions. And this came out during the campaign. Workers across the country, in the warehouses, in the trucks, feel that they have to pee in bottles. Because if they try to get to the restroom in the warehouse, they're going to be penalized for not meeting their targeted pace. And they're going to be disciplined or lose their job. They're afraid to go to the restrooms. And so they pee in bottles. It's pretty bad. We can't let that be the future of work in the United States. And I'll tell you, this campaign has inspired people all over the globe. And it's people in other countries even have another perspective on it than we do. And they say that all those people who came and voted for the union represents the largest group of Amazon workers ever anywhere to stand up to their employer. And if these workers are willing to stand up to Amazon and all it represents, then workers anywhere can stand up to their employer.
That's incredible. I'm kind of floored. I had all these questions and now I'm like, it's amazing because of the global context, which we've covered on the show with Amazon and logistics, and the fact that folks around the world were watching it so closely. So I guess with your, you know, this sort of vast approach to work organizations, food and logistics, you know, you guys do retail, wholesale, chicken plants, now farm workers, you know, you guys are still pushing on Amazon and logistics. What's the vision?
And we also did car wash workers in New York City, and we transformed an industry.
And I had that no idea.
Show people were making $1.70 an hour.
Right.
It was amazing, and we had a huge victory there in New York City, not that long ago, where we were finally able to require at least a minimum wage. They were not required to pay a minimum wage before. And they were getting a sub-minimum wage, which they weren't even receiving. And we have organized car washes in New York City. And by the way, we're standing with the One Fair Wage movement, even though they're not in our industry.
Awesome.
They're not our workers or would be our members, but we're saying that everyone, including restaurant workers, deserve to get one fair wage, that they should not be required to subsist on a sub-minimum wage.
So with the sort of media campaign around you know, workers and wages right now, that you see a lot of disinformation, that there's, you know, workers don't want to go back to work. You know, we say, you know, they say there's worker shortages. We say there's wage shortages, but you see this big move now by a lot of retailers to raise wages and increase some of the benefits, even though they're, you know, not union supporters or they're not unionized. You know, what do you think about the current market conditions for food system workers in terms of, you know, how things are with these employers? And what's the plug for why they should consider, you know, being unionized, you know, or reaching out to RWDSU, other unions to become organized, or organizing themselves in whatever way?
You need to stand together. You need to come together collectively. There are all sorts of things that you need. You need better wages and you need better benefits, but you also need to know that when an employer decides to discipline you or fire you, you're not on your own, that the union has your back and is going to be there with you. You need to make sure that people are not treated in a discriminatory way, where some people are paid better than others or promoted before others because the employer may not like some people or may like other people more. You need to have protection to make sure that whatever you're getting is going to last. Amazon gave workers a $2 increase at the beginning of the pandemic. And then in May of 2020, the end of May, they took that $2 increase away. We struck Mott's applesauce a number of years ago because when they had one of their most productive years, they were part of Dr. Pepper Snapple at the time, and it had one of its most productive years, they announced in negotiations that they wanted to cut wages. They said to us, well, the supply of unemployed people in the area in which you operate in rural New York has increased, and workers needed to think of themselves as a commodity, just like soybeans, so that if the supply goes up, wages should go down. The only protection you have is having a union, having a collective bargaining agreement. And it's people have to come together, and they have to come together in unions.
What's the future for RWDSU? What's the next few years entail?
Organize, organize, organize. That is the future for the labor movement. Politicians aren't going to do it for us. But what we need to do is organize. Workers need to organize, regardless of who is in office.
Stuart Applebaum, president of RWDSU, any closing thoughts for our audience at the checkout?
If we want to build a better country, if we want to deal with income inequality, if we want to ensure that people are treated justly and fairly and safely on the job, the only way to do it is by people coming together and having a collective voice. And what that means is that we need unions in this country. And I'm optimistic about the future. More people than in a very long time now understand the importance of unions. And what is really exciting is that among younger people, that recognition is even greater. I'm optimistic for the future. Come and join us.
Awesome. Thank you, Stuart.